1972, Joey Gallo killed in Little Italy during dinner at Umberto's Clam House.
An hour from now, be it tonight, or 100 years from now, I'm in jail. I mean,
they get there by violence, and often as not, they leave by violence.
Between $3 and $5 million in cash and valuables was taken from the Lufthansa cargo terminal out at Kennedy Airport.
I can give you guys $500,000 a year without a problem.
New York City is a war zone for mobsters and their targets.
Hello everyone, and welcome into part 2 of episode 47 of The Black Hand, an organized crime history podcast. I'm your host, Bliss Grieve, and on today's show, we'll be finishing up our dive into the many different aspects of organized crime in the Golden Triangle region. Last week, we talked about the history and evolution of drug trafficking in the region, and how it became a staple. But that's just a part of the crime that goes on in the region, and many other rackets like the illegal gem trade, wildlife trafficking, illegal logging, and arms trafficking prop up the criminal economy of the region. Before we get started, if you want to support the show, please rate it and go follow the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Hand Pod, and please feel free to reach out. Also, consider giving a little bit to the show's Venmo at The Black Hand Pod as well. The link's in the description. But without further ado, let's get right into today's episode. Last week, we talked about the international reach that the Golden Triangle has in the drug game and how profitable that has been for the region. But all that money has to go somewhere. So to start today's episode, we're going to talk about the money laundering activity related to the Golden Triangle. The purpose of money laundering is to turn funds obtained from illegal activities like the Golden Triangle drug trade into legal assets such as bank deposits. Traditionally, incomes from the drug trade and other illicit activities in the Golden Triangle were laundered through banks in Thailand, Hong Kong, and Singapore. The funds would be sent through a series of regional and international bank accounts and finally into a private or business account somewhere in the world. Once there, it would be next to impossible to trace the origin of the money. According to international financial experts, money laundering goes through three main stages: placement, layering, and integration. The first step is placement. Drug addicts and small-scale dealers pay in cash to their suppliers, who end up with a lot of paper currency in different denominations, which have to be deposited into bank accounts, which can be done locally by funneling them through cash-heavy businesses like bars, nightclubs, restaurants, supermarkets, and gas stations. While in countries outside the region to which the drugs have been smuggled and sold to local addicts, money laundering can be done through a method called smurfing. The nickname comes from the so-called hired hands, or smurfs, who go in and out of different banks, making deposits of illegal funds into multiple accounts, often using various aliases. But most banks in Australia, the United States, and Europe have limits on how much cash can be deposited into a single account without it being reported to tax authorities. As a result, quote-unquote smurfs typically make deposits just under that limit. In this way, money enters the financial system without drawing the attention of government institutions or financial watchdogs, which requires a money launderer to break up large bank-to-bank transactions into a series of smaller transactions that fall under the reporting threshold of most Western financial institutions. In the US, Europe, Canada, and Australia, the daily limit for depositing or withdrawing money without the banks having to report it to tax authorities is roughly around $10,000. Breaking up these transfers effectively disconnects money derived from illegal activities from the actual source, which could be drug trafficking or any related illicit business. Generally, the more layers that dirty money passes through, the harder it becomes for law enforcement authorities to track funds back to criminal activity. Layering can include changing the nature of the origin of the assets, which could be claimed to be from the sale of gold, winnings at a legal casino, or above-the-board ventures. This is often done by sending money around the world using a series of transactions involving tax havens and financial service centers in offshore locations. And with each jurisdiction that the money passes through, it becomes even harder to trace. The third and final step in money laundering is called integration. And in this final stage, once the illegal assets have been placed, layered, and hidden behind supposedly legal businesses and bank deposits, the funds have to be integrated into the legitimate financial system, which must be done through legal sources to create a plausible explanation for where the money originates. The money is then sent back to the people from the criminal organizations that invested in the Golden Triangle drug trade or other illegal activities. After this third stage, it becomes next to impossible for law enforcement agencies to distinguish between legal and illegal incomes, and the criminal organization that laundered the money can now use it with little or no chance of being caught. At this point, the dirty money has been successfully cleaned and absorbed into the mainstream economy, and can now be used for investment in real estate or other legitimate business enterprises. However, in some countries like Thailand, following all three steps may not be necessary, since large amounts of money can usually be deposited into one account and transferred to an overseas bank with no questions asked. But if that destination account is in a country like the US, Canada, Australia, or Europe, transfers would have to be broken up into smaller amounts to avoid the reporting requirement. In addition, there is also a local method for hiding dirty money from the prying eyes of international financial authorities called underground banking systems. These underground banks can transfer money worldwide faster and more efficiently than ordinary banks, which are burdened by legal restrictions. These banks leave no paper trail to be scrutinized by local tax authorities or intelligence agents, which are trying to track the global flow of illicit money. An underground bank operator often also doubles as a travel agent, money changer, or gold dealer. So if a criminal wants to transfer money from northern Thailand to China, Hong Kong, Singapore, or Dubai, he can deposit any amount of cash into one such underground bank, and another or the same person can pick up the same amount at a connected travel agent, money changer, or gold dealer in any of those jurisdictions. An underground banking operator can also move money out of a country by importing goods at overvalued prices and exporting goods for undervalued prices, and vice versa. Almost any type of product can be used for this laundering tactic, including electronics, textiles, expensive carpets, or building materials. Regardless of which one is used, the parties involved still have to balance their books since somebody is running at a deficit and somebody at a surplus. This can be done through more informal transfers or by personally visiting banks to collect the cash in a local currency or in US dollars. But it really wasn't until the late 80s that this complex system of money laundering would become a much-needed commodity. The region's economic boom began in March and April 1989 when the Hill Tribe rank and file of the insurgent Communist Party of Burma mutinied against its aging, orthodox, mainly Burman leadership and drove them into exile in China. Four ethnic armies emerged from the old CPB, and that coincided with the flight of thousands of pro-democracy activists from urban centers to the frontier area. They had fled from massacres in the old capital, Yangon, and other cities and towns, and wanted to fight together with the ethnic rebels against the new military government that had seized power in September 1988. But those ethnic armies only had a handful of weapons that they could share with the urban activists. Only the former CPB forces had warehouses of weapons which had been supplied by China from 1968 to 78. Now, with only ethnic rebels in the country, there was a possibility of an alliance between the former CPB forces, now ethnic armies, and other resistance forces, which could have changed the course of Myanmar's decades-long civil wars. The new ruling military government in Yangon approached the CPB mutineers and made them an offer. They could maintain control over their respective areas and keep their guns, and even engage in any kind of business, as long as they didn't fight them or share their arsenal with other rebel groups. The mutineers, who controlled vast poppy-growing area in the Golden Triangle, accepted the offer, and opium production more than doubled within a year after the mutiny. The threat against the local military government had been neutralized, but the ceasefire agreements also meant that an entirely new era in the Golden Triangle drug trade was ushered in. and it came with huge amounts of money that had to be laundered, some of it through the newly established casinos, but most of it through banks in Myanmar and Thailand. And when methamphetamines joined opium as a Golden Triangle drug production staple, the region also experienced the arrival of an abundance of casinos, in which the drug money and income from other illicit activities can easily be laundered. This new boom of gambling centers, many of which counted organized crime groups as investors, was fueled by the establishment of the so-called special economic zones to promote business in northwestern Laos and eastern and northern Myanmar. According to the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, an estimated 240 casinos have been built in 120 special economic zones in the Mekong subregion, and some of these areas have become hubs for serious criminal activity. The first casinos were established in an area controlled by the National Democratic Alliance, Eastern Shan State, one of the groups that emerged from the collapse of the Communist Party of Burma in 1989. This group's headquarters at Mong La, on the Chinese border, was transformed from a village consisting mostly of bamboo huts to a modern city with luxury hotels, fancy restaurants, brothels, and a ton of casinos. The NDAA ESS was also involved in the drug trade and associated with other drug trafficking groups in the Golden Triangle. Before the COVID-19 pandemic and the imposition of China's zero-COVID policy, which still remains in force, thousands of tourists from China crossed the border each day to enjoy the entertainment that was provided in Mong La. This cross-border traffic led to a massive outflow of money from China, and the Chinese authorities have therefore, on several occasions, tried to control the tourist trade in Mong La. But they've had limited success, because the NDAA leadership has a relationship with China's security agencies that goes back decades, to the days of the Communist Party of Burma. Casinos were also established along the China-Myanmar border area, controlled by the United Wa State Army, the main ethnic force that emerged from the collapse of the CPB. But the USWA earns most of its money from the trade in opium, heroin, and now methamphetamines. However, the Golden Triangle region also has a disturbing penchant for the trafficking of people as well as drugs and money. The networks involved in human trafficking of the Golden Triangle are essentially the same as those that trade in drugs, and the reason for that is simple. Only those gangs know the routes and have the necessary contacts. The first trafficked peoples to flow through this region were Chinese citizens who wanted to go to the United States, the preferred destination, but also to Japan, Taiwan, Australia, or Europe, anywhere that the migrants could attain their dream of a better life. But thanks to rising living standards in China, the mass amounts of fleeing citizens has died down. In the next wave were North Koreans, who made their perilous journey through China to Laos and then northern Thailand, where they were processed by Thai and South Korean authorities as seeking political asylum and then allowed to continue to South Korea. They were, in other words, treated differently from other people who had been smuggled through the Golden Triangle. North Koreans are still coming to Thailand, but more controls have made it increasingly difficult to smuggle people across China, and the COVID-19 pandemic had made it much more difficult. Now, in a new wave of migrants, men and women from Myanmar are escaping hardships in their home country and looking for jobs in Thailand. Following the 2021 military coup in Myanmar, more people from that country are fleeing the government's rule and worsening economic conditions. The International Labor Organization even stated in a 2019 report that there were 2.9 million registered migrant workers in Thailand, comprising nearly 8% of the nation's total workforce. The actual figure, including all of those who are not registered, could be at least twice the number. Those in the northern Thai city of Chiang Mai are mostly Shan and have come across the mountains from the Myanmar sector of the Golden Triangle, escorted by gangs that charge a hefty price for smuggling people into Thailand. The Shans, Myanmar's largest ethnic minority group, are closely related to the Thais when it comes to language and culture, making Thailand an attractive destination for many Shans. These migrants from Myanmar dominate the workforce in Chiang Mai's construction sector, while many Shans also work as farmhands or perform other low-wage, menial labor that Thais are reluctant to do. These migrant workers are often cheated out of their salaries and mistreated. The Thai police often apprehend them for minor offenses and then demand bribes. And despite being closely related to the Thais, the Shans also face prejudice from the local population in northern Thailand. And as if that wasn't enough, most Myanmar workers in Thailand are heavily indebted to the gangs that transported them across the border. So as you can see, apart from being a center for money laundering and drug trafficking, the Golden Triangle Special Economic Zone has also become a hub for human trafficking. Many of the victims are young Lao women who have been lured into prostitution. In the Thai city of Mae Sot, about 300 miles away from Bangkok, thousands of Myanmar workers are employed in local industries. Thousands of Myanmar migrants also work in the fishing industry, which is mainly based near Bangkok. Some migrants in Mae Sot have tried to organize unions, but that's illegal under Thai law, as only citizens are allowed to join unions. But those who came before it belong to a category that differs markedly from what the migrants from Myanmar have to endure today. Most are casual visitors, but some come to stay. They had money and were able to buy Thai ID documents. That was usually done by first staying in one of the old Kuomintang settlements in the Thai sector of the Golden Triangle. Being Chinese, they can also, for a fee, be included in the house registration of Chinese families that have lived in Thailand for generations and are now citizens. The next illicit step toward achieving more legitimate status is to upgrade that local ID to a citizenship card, a difficult goal for most migrants. Another huge racket within the Golden Triangle region is wildlife trafficking. The once sleepy town of Mong La, on Myanmar's border with China, first became a center for drug trafficking and gambling, but now has also developed into a hub for the illegal trade of wildlife products. This was highlighted as early as 2017 in a report compiled by an NGO mapping the illegal trade in wild animals and plants. Based on its investigations, including visits to Mong La, they identified 10 of the worst widely trafficked animal products in the Golden Triangle. This included tiger skin, paws and bones, parts of elephants such as ivory, hair, teeth, bones, tails, and trunks, meat and scales from pangolins, bears, and especially their bile, rhino horns, hornbills, leopard skins, and various kinds of turtles. The main market is China, where rhino horns are believed to be an aphrodisiac, while bear bile and pangolin meat are considered a delicacy. Pangolin scales are also popular in traditional medicine in China and Vietnam. Wildlife products for sale in Mong La come from Myanmar itself, but also from northeastern India and as far away as Africa. Wildlife products are also for sale in the Golden Triangle Special Economic Zone in Laos's Baguio Province. There are even a number of criminal-run tiger farms inside the zone where tigers are bred and then sold. This trade is run by international criminal gangs that are also involved in narcotics, money laundering, and human trafficking. And while the exact value of the Golden Triangle trade in wildlife products isn't known, the total global trade is reported to bring in around $23 billion. According to the European Commission, illegal trafficking in wildlife products is believed to be the fourth most lucrative transnational crime after drugs, weapons, and human trafficking. And due to the lawless nature of the Golden Triangle, it's hardly surprising that a large part of the regional as well as the global wildlife trade takes place there. But the growth of the trade in wildlife only came in the wake of major events in the Golden Triangle and adjacent territories, including the 1989 collapse of the Communist Party in Burma and China's economic boom in the 1990s, which resulted in the emergence of a new class of Chinese entrepreneurs in search of business opportunities. The former CPB forces deal with the Myanmar government, which had enabled them to set up autonomous areas along the Chinese frontier and expand their involvement in the drug trade, made it possible for them to engage in other types of illegal activities, and one of the most lucrative turned out to be the trade of wildlife products. Mong La, under the control of the National Democratic Alliance Army, Eastern Shan State, became the main center for that trade. The group's leaders had excellent contacts with local officials in China's Yunnan province, as well as with other Chinese criminal organizations. At the same time, a series of policy initiatives in Laos encouraged a more open market-oriented economy. Private traders were allowed to compete with state enterprises, and the cross-border trade with China increased dramatically as a result of these new policies. It also served to improve China's long-standing connections with northern Laos and eastern Myanmar. But it also facilitated cross-border trafficking of contraband and provided opportunities for criminal organizations to move into new illegal markets in the Golden Triangle. And it was this shift in Lao economic policy that led to the establishment of the Golden Triangle Special Economic Zones. And though the rackets we've talked about so far make up most of the organized crime in the Golden Triangle, it's by no means all of it. And besides being notorious for drug trafficking, wildlife smuggling, and illegal immigration, the Golden Triangle has also become one of the world's leading areas for unlawful mining, logging, antiquities trading, and arms production. But mining for rare earth minerals by far is the most lucrative of these illicit trades. Rare earth metals are essential ingredients for making products like cell phones, computers, electric vehicles, and defense applications such as guidance systems, lasers, radar, and sonar. The mining in Myanmar is illegal because no official export licenses are issued. But the military turns a blind eye to it because of its ceasefire with the United Wa State Army, which controls most of the mines. Rare earth mining especially has become a major income for the UWSA, possibly even rivaling the drug trade in profitability. China is the main destination for these minerals, which are used in the electronics industry without foreign customers knowing where they came from. And the groundwork for the earth mining racket was really laid in the late 1980s and early 90s with the ceasefire agreements between the Myanmar military and various rebel groups. Likely because most of these rare earth mines are located in areas under the control of rebel groups, specifically the UWSA and the New Democratic Army Kachin. The latter is an armed group of former CPB forces that also made a peace with the Myanmar military in 1989. There are also two mines in KIA-controlled areas near the Chinese border, but their output is limited compared to what is being extracted near the NDAK's base. As a result, Myanmar is the world's third largest producer of rare earth metals after the US and China. And though China is the most prolific rare earth metal producer, they still rely heavily on imports from Myanmar, including illegally trafficked rare earth minerals from militia-controlled border areas. Jade, too, has been smuggled to Thailand and China for decades, but that trade could be considered semi-legal, as some miners and traders do have export licenses. Regardless, jade is a multi-billion dollar industry today. Antiquities like Buddha statues and other items from temples, as well as old coins, jewelry, and artifacts, are also routinely smuggled into Thailand and Myanmar. The illegal trade in antiquities has become more difficult due to international supervision. However, there is a slow but growing demand in China for particular types of ancient, line-decorated beads, which apparently can only be found in historical sites in Myanmar. Timber trading in the 1990s and early 2000s was another massive enterprise in the region, with entire areas inside Myanmar being cut down. The practice, which had both legal and illegal aspects, has declined in recent years because of export restrictions put in place by China, the main destination for illicit logging, and the fact that most of the forest in northern Myanmar are gone. This was yet another result of the freedom granted to militia groups after the ceasefire agreements in the late 80s and early 90s. Hundreds of loaded timber trucks could be seen heading back into China from Myanmar's sector of the Golden Triangle daily. An NGO even estimated that in 2006, this racket was bringing in around $250 million every year. And that 95% of Myanmar's wood exports to China lacked licenses and failed to pay the necessary taxes. Since then, there's been a significant decline in those exports, but timber remains a notable source of income for several rebel groups and militias in the Golden Triangle. Another illegal activity that has taken off in recent years is the production and trade of weapons. Myanmar's rebel groups have always had the capacity to repair old guns and make their own rifle ammunition and landmines. But more recently, clandestine gun factories have been established in the Golden Triangle and adjacent areas. The first known such facility was set up in September 2006 near Koon Ma, 125 miles north of the UWSA's headquarters on the Chinese border. It was reported to be manufacturing replicas of Chinese-designed M22 assault rifles, M23 light machine guns, and the 7.62mm ammunition used by both weapons. Raw materials and spare parts, as well as the technical expertise needed for the production, came from China, and it's uncertain to what extent Chinese authorities are complicit in the gun trade. However, most of the weaponry in the UWSA's arsenal, including infantry weapons, artillery, light armored cars, surface-to-air missiles, and even weaponized drones, are acquired from China. The Kachin Independence Army, or KIA for short, doesn't have the same relationship with the Chinese, as the UWSA has its own weapons factory where it produces assault rifles also based on Chinese designs and manufactured with raw material and parts from China. Those guns are used by the KIA's troops and aren't sold to other rebel armies or militias. The NDAK also became a major player in a number of trafficking businesses, and that includes arms. They also have a gun factory that produces pistols, revolvers, and shotguns. Among their customers for the arms are ethnic rebels from northeastern India who have their bases on the Myanmar side of the border. Weapons from Thailand are also found all over the Golden Triangle and other border regions. But that's really all I have for you guys today. I hope you all thoroughly enjoyed today's show, and tune back in next week for episode 48. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating and follow the show's Instagram and Twitter pages at The Black Hand Pod. And feel free to reach out with feedback, suggestions, and comments. Also, please consider giving a little bit to the show's Venmo at The Black Hand Pod as well. But with that said, I hope you all have a great rest of your day. This is your host, Bliss Grebe, signing out.